Welcome back to Talking History. This interview is the second in our two-part exploration of the use of history in opera, or to be more specific, the use of history in a new opera by Opera Omaha, The Trial of Standing Bear, that has just begun production. We talked to Jane Hill, Opera Omaha's executive director who wrote the libretto. We're pleased to have with us composer Brent Michael Davids, who has written the music for the opera. Davids is an internationally known composer. He's classically trained, but he's also a member of the Mohican Indian Nation, and his work has been described as reflecting both Western compositional techniques and elements of American Indian music. His work has been performed by such groups as the Joffrey Ballet, the National Symphony Orchestra, and the Boston Symphony. Welcome, Brent.
Hi.
Brent, explain to us this mix that has been used to describe your music of Western and Indian elements.
Well, mostly it's a mix on several different levels. On one level, traditionally for native tribes, there is really no conceptual category of music at all for traditional natives. Music is a very Western concept. It's more compartmentalized. It's a piece of what tribes would consider part of something else, a whole, a dance, a ceremony. And music is not conceptually separated from those events the same way it is in the West. So when I'm mixing the elements, I'm dealing with, on the one hand, something which is very narrowly defined as music, and then on the other hand, a more holistic experience of song and dance and ceremony, in which I'm only, you know, dealing with small parts of something else.
Okay, now this is not new. I was surprised in preparing to this to read about other composers in the past that have tried to work in indigenous elements, and yet you seem to receive a great deal of praise for having a particular sympathy or understanding, perhaps coming from your heritage, your lineage. Would you care to comment, maybe unfair, on some composers in the past that have tried to use this tradition and what has happened?
Well, I have the advantage of writing from the inside perspective. There's been a whole history of people borrowing or being inspired by native music all the way as far back as Rameau, who's credited, I think, in the Enlightenment period of writing music. He went to in Louisiana area or whatever. He saw a couple native dancers dancing and went back to Europe and wrote a couple parts of a ballet. One's called Le Sauvage and the Savages, and then the Gallant Indian are parts of a ballet. And basically they're just sort of a waltz in a minor key on harpsichord. So they don't sound at all native, but that was sort of his borrowed inspiration of the idea. And several other composers have done, Dvorak and some other composers. But being the insider, I mean, in a very basic way, only natives can do native music, because we have a responsibility to the tribes, to our people. In other words, the music I write, I'm responsible for personally, but I'm also responsible to a whole tribe of relatives who are looking over my shoulder. And there's just no way a non-native composer can be that responsible. You know, there are songs that, ritual songs that were maybe collected and recorded by early ethnologists floating around there. So they probably should not have been recorded in the first place. And then here comes, some non-native composer who goes through the field recordings available today and maybe uses that song, and then you hear the song for, cello and piano, but it should not have been used in the first place and probably should not have been recorded in the first place. So it's like a mistake compounded by another mistake compounded by another mistake.
Okay. Well, let's see how that works. We have a piece here from your first symphony, which will debut in December in New Mexico, Powwow, A Gathering of Nations. We'll listen to a piece, and I'll ask you to comment on it.
Great.
Thank you.
So what's Western and what's Indian?
Well, I'd just go on the record and say that that was all 100% Brent Michael Davids. But it's influenced in both Native influences and Western. Of course, it's Western instruments, you know, violins and orchestra instruments, as well as some Native percussion instruments. And it's basically an adagio, which is sort of a kind of a form from Western orchestra music. And the rhythms, though, are Native. It's a very slow heartbeat pattern that was going on in that movement. And, the, you know, it's just the heartbeat, you know, boom, 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 boom. But in Western music, I think the closest approximation would be kind of a five-count beat, like where the accents are on one and three. So it's like one, two, three, four, five, one, two, three, four, five, one, two, three, four, five, boom, 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 boom. That's kind of the heartbeat pattern. And you heard that as well in this little movement.
Okay, now you mentioned Western instrumentation. You play the crystal flute. Do you do that because it best exemplifies Indian qualities, or maybe you should describe the instrument first?
Right, it's a flute made out of quartz crystal, and it was developed first by Michael Wheeler and myself, and then later by Don Galvin. I've actually shattered three of them, so I'm playing crystal flute number 4, and I have number 5 in backup now. I learned to keep a spare. But it's actually a mix. There's a traditional... It's traditional for flute players, Native flute players, to play flute. They make their own flutes and then perform on them as solo instruments. They're usually not with accompanying instruments. And my flute is sort of a mix. It's a transverse flute, or you blow across the hole on the side of the instrument, similar to a Western metal, you know, orchestral flute. But then it only has 6 holes on the side of it, so it's essentially like tuned like a Native flute would be tuned. And so it's actually a hybrid, kind of a mix of both worlds.
Okay, well, maybe we should listen to it in our next piece, Indian Killer, and then you can describe where that comes from.
Sure.
Lovely instrument. What's tell us about Indian Killer. What's that about?
Indian Killer is a soundtrack from 2 scenes that I composed for Robert Redford's Sundance Film Institute. They've been running directors' laboratories and screenwriter laboratories where those people go and work on with professionals in the area. And last summer, they started the first composer's laboratory. So I went and worked with professional composers in L.A. and learned how to score for film. And the emphasis is not on learning to compose. I mean, you're assuming the composers going to the lab know how to compose. The idea was to learn what composers are supposed to score for film, how to write music in and out of dialogue and to help, you know, move a scene along when it needs it, or create mood music for a particular film. And this was music from Sherman Alexie's upcoming film called Indian Killer, which is taken from the novel Indian Killer. And his first movie, of course, was Smoke Signals, which is out on Miramax now.
Right, that was a good film. You're here to do Trial of Standing Bear. What attracted you to this story?
What attracted me to it is that it's a story of basic human rights for Native Americans, where Standing Bear is really the first test case for the court system to decide whether natives are actually people or not. Before that, you know, we're not considered people. We were romanticized in the, you know, in the 1900s, and like, you know, when Thoreau was, you know, romanticizing the natural environment, so to speak, or that, you know, natives became sort of noble. But earlier time periods in the early colonies, like in Massachusetts and the colonies, nature was seen as somewhat evil. You know, it was a very harsh environment, and people living out in nature, you know, i.e. Native Americans, were also considered evil and devils. If you look through the Winthrop journals and some other earlier writings, you can find all sorts of references to natives as sort of devilish creatures running around there. But Standing Bear is the first case where, you know, the courts had to decide, you know, are we people or not?
The trial takes place in 1879, so we're talking about an historical event here. How do you compose an opera? Does it make any difference that it's an historical event?
Well, it does and it doesn't. I mean, in one sense, we're producing a piece of performance here, you know, so that it needs to have drama, and the music is partly underscoring, you know, from what I'm concerned with. So I want to write music that's halfway, you know, or somewhat familiar to the audiences now listening to it. At the same time, I wanted to capture some kind of historical flavor for the opera itself and also the characters. So I've been listening to a lot of Ponca music and listening to Ponca language, and I'm trying to capture that flavor in the work itself. And then going through the different characters and trying to figure out what music from their particular character background might sound like, and incorporating those ideas into the
Give us an example of how you did that, maybe with Standing Bear, for example.
Standing Bear, what I did was I tried to create an aria for him. He gives this famous speech in the courtroom where he's basically appealing to the judge to decide, you know, in favor of letting him live as a free person and not forcing him to go live on the reservation. And I developed it as a trio, basically because I wanted to capture, again, the same idea that natives feel a responsibility to their communities. We don't live essentially as autonomous individuals. In a sense, we are a part of a collective tribe. So when I thought of writing his aria, I wanted to have other voices in there. So the beginning of the aria for him is actually a duet of Standing Bear singing in Ponca and the interpreter, who is the daughter of another friend, a Ponca friend, who is singing in English in the duet. And then toward the end of the aria, both characters are joined by Bear Shield, who's a 16-year-old age, you know, about 16-year-old age son of Standing Bear, who had passed away, and they were actually going to bury, you know, the bones. They describe having the Bear Shield's bones in a box they've been hauling around on their 500-mile march. And his ghost appears in the court and joins them at the very end of the aria. And they're singing vocables.
Mm-hmm. Take a different character. Take a contrasting. Well, actually, he's not exactly contrasting. General Crook, he clearly is the voice of authority here of the U.S. government. On the other hand, he's troubled by all of this because he's not absolutely clear in his conscience that what he's doing is the right thing. How'd you represent that?
Well, the obvious influences there for music or whatever are the military. So he's very military. So that I pulled from ideas from that. Also, General Crook and the newspaper man, Tibbles, each of them spent a year living with the Ponca at different times. So they each have that in their background. So when I was working on the, for instance, the Tibbles and Crook duet, they meet in this, you know, bar somewhere, a pub, and they have a discussion, and General Crook is trying to convince Tibbles that they should try and take this case to court, you know. And Tibbles is, of course, you know, this is unheard of, taking, you know, having a Native American actually, you know, go to court over anything, because we weren't considered people at that point, and we didn't have the rights to a trial. So they have this whole scene together, and Crook and Tibbles each rely and banter back and forth a little bit, but their connection is the year that they each spent with the Ponca for that scene. And so what I did is I turned that scene into sort of a Ponca game song or a gaming song. So you have Tibbles, who's, you know, the wanderer who's left his family at an early age, and he was out on his own as a boy, and he's got this sort of folk element in his music. And then you've got General Crook, who I think was raised on a farm as well, and then joined the service at an early age and sort of wandered around as well, relocated, you know, as military people do. So you've got both of those elements, but they each share a little bit of Ponca. So I mixed a little bit of Ponca in with this duet as well.
Right. Yeah. Tibbles is an interesting character as well, because he's a person who's very idealistic as a young man, and sort of losing his idealism, is reluctant to get involved in this. So that, do you convey any of this as well, or is that difficult to work in when you have this kind of background to his character?
No, yeah, that's what the whole scene is about, actually, the scene. General Crook is trying to convince Tibbles to go ahead and not just settle for the status quo, but, you know, go after this one too. You know, you worked for the abolitionists and you've done all these other things, and, you know, work for Standing Bear too, and I have a new idea. And he goes ahead and tells him his idea.
Right. Well, this is going to be a unique experience, undoubtedly, for opera goers. If you had the opportunity, you were standing in the lobby as these people enter, what would you like them to take away from this opera? What are you trying to deliver in the way of a message through your music?
Well, hopefully, I think for opera goers who are, you know, generally used to going to operas, I hope they come away with a sense of what it means to be Ponca and what it means to be Native American. They're going to certainly hear Ponca melodies and rhythms and see Ponca elements in the music as well as the opera. But also I'm hoping that Native Americans will come and see the opera. I don't know about you, but there are not a lot of, you know, opera goers on the reservation. But hopefully they'll be compelled, knowing the Native American history and culture, to come see the Trial of Standing Bear, the opera, and somehow become, you know, interested in what operas are all about.
Well, it couldn't have come at a more opportune time because of the strain that's been in Nebraska between the state and some of the Native Americans. So it'll be interesting to see what follows. But thank you for joining us today, and good luck with the opera. You've been listening to Brent Michael Davids, composer of the music for Opera Omaha's new opera, The Trial of Standing Bear, and we will close with another piece from his Indian Killer. For Op-Ed of the Week, we turn to a contemporary member of the Ponca Indian Nation to get her assessment of the opera, The Trial of Standing Bear, her view of the historical event and how it is being brought to the stage. Judy Morgan is also the executive director of the Nebraska Commission on Indian Affairs.
Great operas, musical dramas are most often about important events, heroic people, great acts of courage, and they are often laced with tragedy and irony, and often end with great triumph for humankind, the triumph of good over evil. In what promises to be a great American opera, The Trial of Standing Bear has all of this. It tells a story that is a story of many or most Indian tribes in America. It is a story of forced removal from beloved tribal homelands that had sustained and nurtured the people from time immemorial, theft of their lands to accommodate greed in massive new markets of invading foreigners. It is a story of treachery and perpity of treaties held sacred by the native peoples, twisted and broken and thrown aside. It is a story of great sadness and unspeakable horror in a forced march to territories far away. Men, women, and children, newborn infants, and helpless elders forced to travel through the violent weather of the stark plains. the Trail of Tears experienced by many tribes in that infamous period known as the Removal Period. It is a story of a great leader, no less than Moses, who led the Israelites from captivity back to their promised land. Again, a terribly difficult trek through harsh conditions, this time pursued by the military. Of Standing Bear refusing to return his people to captivity and being arrested for his righteous crime of resistance. It is also a story of compassion and goodness and the great desire for justice on the part of some true Americans. The story is well known here in Nebraska and throughout Indian America of a court decision that determined American Indian people to be persons under the law for purposes of habeas corpus. More than a century after the Constitution, that most sacred document in the history of mankind, was adopted, Indians still had to prove their being as humans. The eloquence of Standing Bear's defense is a stuff of great libretto. And I quote, "My hand is not the same color as yours, but if you pierce it, I shall feel the pain. The blood will be the same color. We are men, the same God made us. All I ask is what is mine. My land, my freedom, my dignity as a man." We commend Opera Omaha for this labor of love, love of courage and justice. It is a work that will make Native Americans everywhere proud and vindicated. And it will make Americans proud that its democratic process of justices have worked. And with great commitment, the system can still work, a century after Standing Bear's trial, to bring our people out of the terrible poverty and suffering that plagues much of Indian country today.
You've been listening to Judy Morgan, member of the Ponca Nation and executive director of the Nebraska Commission on Indian Affairs.
Freedom, equal, freedom, free, equal, free, freedom.
The court. He is not an officer of the court and cannot address it. Dismiss this court. The court is now dismissed.
That's it for another week of Talking History. We will close with an aria from the opera, The Trial of Standing Bear. This is Brian LeBeau.
We will return to the swift-running water, pouring down between the green islands. The graves of my pitch our teepee and build our fires. But a man locks away, away. I see soldiers behind him, away.
Advisement.